Good morning and welcome to today's edition of All Sides Weekend, where we talk about books. I'm Christopher Purdy. We're going to be with you for the next hour talking about what's new. And we have a special kind of subplot today, today's program. And if you are somebody who remembers the 60s with a mixture of affection, fear, and oh my God, did I really do that? This is the show for you. I'm pleased to welcome, as always, Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic. Cassie's blog is thelongestchapter.com. Thank you, Cassie, for being here.
It's great to be here.
Kevin Griffith is professor at Capital University, a poet, an author, a teacher, and keeps us sort of all adults on this program. Mm-hmm. Kevin, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And from his office at Wright State, Andrew Strombeck, professor in the English department at Wright State University, who is teaching a course on the literature around the TV series Mad Men. So that's part of the 60s journey we're going to stake. Andrew Strombeck, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Do you remember the 60s since I haven't met you?
No, I was born in 1972,
that's so
I was born right after the show ends, I suppose. Yeah.
Okay, well, some of us remember the 60s, but we're delighted to have you here. We had a conversation on this program a couple of months ago, and I'm not sure how it came up, but we began to talk about Jacqueline Suzanne. And a lot of people probably had no clue who she was, but she outsold the Bible during the 60s. And so I thought it would be great to really try to remember the books that were hot back then, and we're possibly informing, thanks to Andrew, the Mad Men TV phenomenon. Are you, Andrew, a fan of Mad Men, the show itself?
Yes, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, that's where the whole impetus for the class came about. I was watching the class, and lo and behold, Pete Campbell is reading Thomas Pynchon's The Crying of Lot 49, which has always been one of my favorite books and one of my favorite books to teach. And so I was like, wow, what a great way for students to imagine the world around Pynchon's novel.
I haven't seen it lately because it's on past my bedtime, but Cassie Rose has seen all of it, haven't you, on DVD?
I have. I don't have a TV set in my house, but I've been watching it on the DVD series, and I just finished season 6. And I have to say that the Crying of Lot 49, when I saw him reading that, he's sitting on in an airplane. I was really surprised because that's not an easy book to read.
No, it's not. And he's in some ways an unlikely character to be reading it,
yes,
except
he
that he has these kind of intellectual aspirations, you know, on the show, or at least he did early in the show.
Kevin, you mentioned coming in a book that you and I have read, but I didn't realize it was the impetus for this program.
Yeah, we had talked about, I seem to recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the producer of Mad Men handed all the cast members a copy of Revolutionary Road by Richard Yates and said that Richard Yates was the way to sort of get insight into that historical period, and that Yates's book was essentially the basis of the show. And Revolutionary Road has always been one of my favorite books. I believe it was a finalist for the National Book Award in the early 60s. Yates is a tragic character in his own right, but Yates is quite different from Pynchon, though. Yates is a realist and sort of a relentless realist. Do you teach Richard Yates in the course or allude to him?
No, so I haven't. I've taught Richard Yates in another context. I've actually taught him in the context of a 50s course. So just to be clear, the show, I teach only books that are featured on the show, so with some exceptions, or with one important exception that I'll mention. So in order for the book to be part of the class, it has to have been either on someone's bookshelf, or someone has to be reading it, or it has to be like physically seen in the show. But no one reads African-American literature on the show, because for the most part, they're all white. So both times I've taught the course, I've included a book, the first time by James Baldwin, and the second time by Ishmael Reed, to give students a sense of the kind of larger culture going on around the show. So I haven't taught. John Cheever would be the other choice, or other obvious choice.
That's right.
In terms of the cultural material of the show, yeah.
But doesn't Don Draper read Dante's Inferno, and he's reading it on the beach, I think?
Yes, I did not go with Dante's Inferno, because I didn't know how to fit that into the landscape of the 60s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's kind of another reason to roll my eyes at Don Draper, if you don't mind my saying so, with apologies to Dante. I wanted to ask, really, I was struck by somebody was quoting Sylvia Plath in the program, who had probably just died at that moment, that her suicide was 1962, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
So that was timely.
That's right. So I don't remember that moment. There is an episode named Lady Lazarus. It may be that they mention, they might quote lines from Lady Lazarus in that show. But that was one of the, I taught that book during the first iteration of the course. Because, Plath is really great to talk about in terms of the sort of emerging female identities of the time, the kind of proto-feminism of the early 60s.
Is there one book that really, you mentioned Pynchon, is there one book that really struck you? This would be a perfect opportunity to teach this book in a Mad Men context.
Okay, probably Frank O'Hara, the Meditations on an Emergency, because O'Hara is really great to teach. He's a really great poet, and students sort of respond to the immediacy in his poems, but he's also a poet that sometimes feels like he could be writing at any time in the latter half of the century. And so it was really great to say, okay, well, here's Don Draper, again, probably pretentiously or aspirationally reading this book in a bar in Greenwich Village. And so let's talk about how these poems kind of, inhabit this larger 60s that Mad Men is presenting. Yeah.
Cassie, see if you agree with me, or all of you who've seen the show a lot. From what I've seen, there's always an underlying of anger mm-hmm. in the show. This kind of almost nasty tension. Am I correct in that?
I know that a lot of my friends stopped watching the show after the first season or the second season because of that anger, because of also the men who were just trashing their marriages, and the way that it was just very negative and dark is what they described it as. I sort of pushed through that because I had another friend who actually had given me the series and recommended I watch it. And I kept saying, no, it's so dark. And he just said, just keep watching it. And by the time I got to the second, third season, I was taken with it. And the darkness of it didn't bother me. I was captured by the 60s phenomena. Mm-hmm. I liked watching not only the set of the kitchens and their clothes, and also, again, my eye was drawn to a lot of the books, which actually I felt some of it was pretentious, or it felt like it was too slotted.
Deliberately, do you think? Yeah.
Yeah, I felt it was. But maybe it's because I was so aware of it. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think Rosemary's Baby also makes an appearance in it. I mean, the book.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the books that I taught this semester.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Now, the students, because that's a phenomenon that I certainly remember, that we weren't allowed to see the movie when it came out. It was adults only, and that, of course, increased the mystique. But did your students, had they ever heard of it or any of these books?
Some of them had heard of the Polanski film, but
right.
not the book itself. And I think a few of them, we actually taught Valley of the Dolls as well, because that appears in the show, which is kind of an unconventional choice for a literature course. But the course is more, again, about the kind of culture of the 60s
right.
than it is about the kind of, high canon of literary works in the 60s. So some of them had heard of Valley of the Dolls as well, but for the most part, no, they had not heard of the books that we went over.
Well, I'm here to tell you, when those two books first came out, they were kept in libraries in a locked cabinet, and you had to ask for it. You had to ask for them, and if you were 12 or 13 years old, they'd let you have them, but they would make a point of embarrassing you, really, that you had to ask for those books, And now to hear them taught at the university level, I think is terrific. I think we've really kind of evolved that way. But I would think that the ethos or these, the culture certainly Valley of the Dolls is very strange to students today. Not being one, but I imagine.
What I'm curious about, too, is how they did choose the books that they did for Mad Men. And when you start to think of all the books they could be choosing from, like, for example, and maybe it's on a bookshelf. I'm not aware of the books that were sitting on the shelves that in the background. But why not Truman Capote's In Cold Blood that came out in 1966? A landmark book that was very, very popular and certainly, defined writing or literature in terms of taking a real event and turning it into a novel. I mean, that set a standard. It makes me wonder why the producers didn't choose that book. Other books that came out during that time, Portnoy's Complaint came out. Were they all sitting around a table, or did someone just say, oh, let's just have, Pete Campbell read, Pynchon?
That's very interesting. They actually use a Malamud novel, The Fixer, which is a really unlikely choice for the 60s. It's kind of very unreflective of the culture, like in a very different way than Portnoy's Complaint. Portnoy's Complaint is such a 1969 novel, but The Fixers, looking back on this early period in Russian history, it's basically this triumph over anti-Semitism. So I don't know. I think my sense is that they seem to choose novels based on certainly their popularity, what people would have been reading. But then sometimes it feels like they don't try to go for an obvious 60s, which is one of the things I really like about the show. And so it feels like they will sort of veer, right? They'll veer from Roth to Malamud in order to kind of give us a 60s that people haven't necessarily encountered before, which, again, I think is something really neat about the show.
Kevin, I want to ask you... related to this, how do you teach a book? Real seriously, I mean, what do you do? I mean, really, you know.
Well, first you hope that the students read it. That's
right.
Always a really important one. Yes.
Yeah.
The way I teach literature, I'm not necessarily a literature professor. I teach creative writing, so we look a lot at examples of craft and that kind of thing. But when I do teach literature, it's really important to have a discussion even before they've read the book, to have questions that we want to ask going into the book, and to give them some explanation or relevance for why they should be reading it, the importance, why this is valuable to your life. So I think that's very important. We always do that, sort of have a pre-discussion of the book. And I think that's, they have to have that to have some sort of motivation to get through these.
What poet would they have known in 1963, 64, 65 that really anybody would have known who worked?
Definitely
in that?
Sylvia Plath.
Right.
Oh, yeah. We teach Lady Lazarus. That's a very common, that poem in itself. And then her two books, very commonly known by most of the students, and The Bell Jar, that novel. Mm-hmm. Almost many, many students have read The Bell Jar coming into college. So.
So, but I'm talking about, what would Don Draper, 45, 50 years ago, what poet might he know?
Oh.
Besides Sylvia, besides, who would, what poetry?
Well, knowing Don Draper, I would hope he would know, if he were, given what I've heard, that he would know Howl by Allen Ginsberg. He should have had a copy of that by that time. I mean, I think
if he
wanted to look really hip on a plane, I think that's one.
Yeah. Wasn't Charles Bukowski writing during that time?
Well, he came a little bit later. He didn't rise to prominence till the late 60s.
I think Howl in the white collar office, but they'd look at him weird probably if he was reading Howl.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Speaking of looking at it, we have to take a break. We'll be back in a few seconds. Don't go away. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books. Don't go away. I'm Christopher Purdy. We're back with this edition of All Sides Weekend, talking about books. We're talking with Cassie Rose, with Kevin Griffith, and on the phone from Wright State University, Professor Andrew Strombeck. Mr. Strombeck is doing a course. This is not the first year, is it? You've done this before, right?
This is the second time.
The second
That's right.
year. On the premise of the TV series, the hit series Mad Men, what would those characters be reading? What books were featured on that show, even in the background, which is a interesting way to sort of go back to some great books of the 60s that are now, I guess, considered classics because we're still talking about them all this time. And we've had a caller wanting us to mention Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, although I'm not sure anybody on that show was reading that book, or were they?
One wishes they were.
One wishes, yes.
In terms of the way capitalism played out, but sure, yeah.
Well,
no, I don't think so.
Let's open that up. What books would you wish that these people had read? Don Draper and the people in the office, a lot of them have very, very upscale lifestyles. They're making a lot of money. They're living the life. And I don't think we had yet tried to become the slaves to our TVs and everything else. So what do you think, Kevin? What do you think they should have been reading?
Well, Cassie and I were talking during the break about the so-called Rat Pack, and one of those was William Styron, or at least somewhat of a part of it. And I would hope, Styron came to prominence in the late 60s. His first novel came about in the early 60s, and then in the He had The Confessions of Nat Turner, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1968. Mm-hmm. But Sophie's Choice is a great novel, which they wouldn't be reading, of course, because it was published in the 70s. But Styron himself, that's how he got his beginnings. He worked in the New York publishing industry, and the whole beginning of Sophie's Choice is extremely funny, just about his experiences reading these really terrible manuscripts and a guy walking in from Minnesota holding a suitcase with like a 10,000-page manuscript of poetry written in Old Norse or something and wanting to talk to him all day and how he couldn't extract himself from that situation because it was his first job, but he got fired anyways. Seems to be very Mad Men-like. So I would hope maybe they'd pick up Styron's early work. That would be one I'd like to see.
Cassie, what do you think? What would you hope they were reading?
I guess what comes to mind, I suppose, is some of the books that were classics that came out early in the 60s, like Slaughterhouse-Five with Vonnegut, mm-hmm. and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
What about Mailer?
Norman Mailer? Yeah. I was just about to mention Mailer. Yeah, mm-hmm. Armies in the Night would be great to have them reading. Mm-hmm.
I think Mailer kind of fits that kind of pugilistic literary figure that might have been at home in some of the setting of the piece. I'm thinking about my father's generation. You know, they would come home and yell at the kids and play golf and things like that. That's kind of what was going on back there. If you'd like to join our conversation about Mad Men and the books those characters would have liked and or are featured in that program, 292-8513. That's a 614 number, 292-8513. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. For Cassie Rose, Kevin Griffith, or Andrew Strombach, Andrew's course is focusing on Mad Men, the literature the characters were reading are featured on that program. Were you surprised, Andrew, that a lot of books were featured on that program?
Yes, although it's novels are sort of positioned differently in the culture at the time, right? I mean, novels in some ways are more central to the culture of the 60s than they are to our culture. It's not quite the way novels were, say, in the 20s, but because you don't have as many forms of media competing with novels in the 60s. So it's surprising on the one hand, but then on the other hand, it makes perfect sense that Betty Draper is going to be reading a Leanne Urs novel or a Mary McCarthy novel when she's going to bed.
Do you think she read The Feminine Mystique?
Again, one hopes, but Betty's not the one on the show who would be reading that. Peggy might read it, but Betty's a very conservative character, so she would not be wanting to unravel the mystique.
Maybe she caught up in the 80s when her grandchildren were reading them. Who knows?
Yeah, that's right.
We have a call from Beth from Columbus. Hello, Beth. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just calling to say that I have been binge-watching to catch up with season 7, just in case I missed something, and because I love the show. And actually, in season 3, when Betty meets her husband, Henry, her future husband, Henry, the people on the commission for the water have read Silent Spring, and they mention it in the introduction to that part of the show. And then Kinsey, the guy who always wants to be holier than now, in the scene where they have to stay in for the 4th of July and come up with all these lines for Bacardi, he at one point is just laying on the floor and saying the very last lines of Howl.
Oh, don't repeat. Yeah. Don't repeat them now, okay?
Yeah. So, and then at the very beginning, Pete was given a copy of Ayn Rand. I don't know which
one it was.
I think it's the Fountainhead. Yes.
The Fountainhead. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Super believes that that's the way that things should go. Although I think he'd be more into reading Basho or some sort of Japanese Zen type of thing, since that's the way his office and his philosophy tends to be. That's all I had to say.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you so much for that call. I appreciate it. 292-8513. Yo, what about other writers, foreign writers? I mean, were they popular at the time? Were we reading? Or the other thing I remembered was that it was everybody was buying hardcover books back then, weren't they? Pretty much.
Yes, I think that actually the 60s was certainly a defining time in literature, but it also was starting toward the tail end of the golden age of publishing, when we did have the hardcover, the majority of the hardcover books. Certainly paperbacks were out, but it was also in the industry we still had that connection to the author. I think really, you know, 75% of the industry was looking towards, in New York, publishing literature. And it didn't, you know, in the 1980s, the mergers happened, the bottom line became important, and we see what we have today, a very fragmented industry. So I think we get that in the books in the 1960s of the good literature, the Rat Pack, the Updike, the Updike, the Malamud, the Roth, the, and also Taking Chances, but these connection to literature being a very prominent media source, too, that people were connected to and not drawn away by computers and TVs.
I want to throw this out to the three of you. Did books in the 60s, when they, new books in the 60s, were they, had we sort of, our tastes become more sophisticated by then, and books like Roth's books, like Portnoy's Complaint, I think was considered shocking when it first came out, and funny, because it's very funny. But were we expecting a more worldly kind of a novel?
I think some of the novels were showing the times, too, because, I mean, there were riots going on. Women were burning their bras. People were taking drugs. I mean, we were bursting at the seams. And I think literature started to meet that, certainly with Valley of the Dolls it did, too.
But absolutely.
It resonates the time.
Andrew, I think you can make a case even for Rosemary's Baby, reflecting some of that cataclysm as well. You know, it's supposed to be about Satanists, but if you look carefully at the Satanists, they kind of sound a lot like the counterculture. So, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Another novel we looked at was The Last Picture Show, Bertram. It's a lot of sex, a lot of extramarital sex, and it does. And that's 66, so it does seem like literature was right there with the cultural curve, kind of, helping people sort of navigate what seemed to be a rapidly changing world there.
We have a lot of callers waiting with their suggestions for Don Draper or Betty's reading list. Leanne from Columbus. Hello, Leanne. Go ahead.
Oh, hey there.
Go ahead.
Surprised to get on. Thank you very much. A book that I read back in that era, I hate to admit how old I am, but that was kind of hot at the time was The Carpetbaggers.
Harold Robbins.
Correct.
Shame on you.
Yes, Harold Robbins. Oh,
yes.
My gosh.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was, I don't know, I remember it was kind of, I didn't want my parents to see me reading it.
It's one of those flashlight books under the sheets at night. You're reading the flashlights. Yes. Yes. Harold Robbins. Yeah, that's a great name. Thank you very much for that, Liam. We appreciate that.
Sure. Oh, yeah, great show. And I was surprised I never saw anybody read it. It seemed like it would be so apropos to them.
I think we're going to start reviving a certain genre of novel with the local libraries in about 20 minutes. But thank you for that very much.
Well, the thing about Harold Robbins, I remember picking up the first book. I thought, I've got to read Harold Robbins. This was back, you know, in probably the early 70s, or maybe it was late 60s. And I, 2 days later, I could not remember what it was about. That sort of, it's very, you know, that just speaks to what Harold Robbins was writing, very entertaining, very light, very
successful.
Very successful he was, but it was of that genre that it didn't, you know, move you, it wasn't memorable, it wasn't whatever, it's just a great, fun read. But that sticks in my mind from that time of, I could not, and it surprised me, that here I was, I'd read this novel, I couldn't even today tell you what the title was, or what was in the book.
I have to ask, Andrew, because you've mentioned Pynchon. I've missed the Pynchon bus so far. So tell me why that book seemed to be seminal for you. And I asked Kevin to jump in with that, too, because I'm showing my ignorance and I want the experts to talk to me about
it. So this is The Crying Lot 49,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
He's really good at engaging sort of the larger systems of media, but also kind of the larger systems of defense and surveillance that are sort of coming to bear on the world in the post-war era, like kind of the aftermath of World War II, the systems that were built up for World War II. But then the way that he's got a great scene in that novel where he's got a child actor or a former child actor and his girlfriend sitting in a room, and the child actor is pointing to himself on the television, and they're making bets about how the movie on the television is going to turn out. But then they've flipped the reels in the movie, and so she loses the bet, even though she's right about the film or on the television. And so that sense of reflexivity between the television and real life, I think, is just one of the things that he's really after that I find really interesting. Suburbanization is a big theme in that book, too. He's kind of wrestling with the way the American landscape has changed, the way it looks now. There's a moment when the protagonist, Oedipa Mass, comes down on a hill from L.A. or into L.A., and she thinks, oh, it looks like a circuit board laid out. So that's why I find that interesting. It reflects the kind of cultural changes.
And Kevin, you mentioned that term suburbanization as well. I mean, that seemed to be what people were wanting back then. That was a mark of success, yes?
Well, they wanted it, but then it quickly turned into, I would say, considering the popularity of dystopian literature today, that was the first dystopia, the suburbs.
Then Updike wrote Couples, and that
changed. That's right. And then he ushers in Don DeLillo, and then Don DeLillo ushers in David Foster Wallace, and then you sort of have the end of postmodernism. Pynchon was the beginning. So,
Andrew, just so you know, David Foster Wallace is a big deal for us here on the show.
Oh, I love Infinite Jest. Yeah.
Here's a call from Rita in Columbus. Hi, Rita. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. I wanted to contribute some titles I remember from the '60s. One is the James Bond books by Ian Fleming.
Yes.
I was of an age where I was in grade school then, so we couldn't get in to see the films, so we would read the books, which often would turn out to be racier than the films. Another really controversial book I remember was by William Manchester, Death of a President.
Yes.
Which I think Jackie Kennedy brought into court.
Yes.
That was very controversial.
That's interesting you bring that up, because I remember the episode that when JFK was killed, they went over about two or three episodes, and it really seemed like, as it was for many of us, a demarcation point. Everything changed after that, including probably what they were reading. Yes, no?
Yes, I suppose so. And also, I seem to remember another book that was very controversial, and I only remember the title. It was called The Hucksters.
Oh,
and I
yes.
don't remember the author.
It's a Madison Avenue novel.
Yes, it was about the world of advertising, which I think would have had great resonance for the people in the Mad Men demimonde.
Thank you so much, Rita,
Thank
for that
you.
Call.
Uh-huh.
Gina has sent us an email and asked, what do we suppose the kids of Mad Men are reading? And the kids seem kind of neglected or not really well treated. I don't see a lot of loving parenting going on Mad Men to the extent it's featured at all. But she's wondering, is it Nancy Drew, the Bobbsey twins? What do you suppose? I'm thinking Mad Magazine myself, but.
Well, I can there was some great books, children's books that came out. The Phantom Tollbooth came out. Also, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yes, I was going to say that.
Mm-hmm. James and the Giant Peach. Mm-hmm. And Harriet the Spy, Louise Fitzhugh.
That was a good book, too, yeah.
So you would think the kids, because of the way they were treated by their parents, would be escaping into books in their rooms, but they're not.
And maybe they were. Maybe that's a different show. Maybe that's the sequel. Beth from Lithopolis. Hello, Beth. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My junior and high school days were, junior high and high school, were in Kelly's Island. And they had a very small library, and they didn't have a reading list. The school did order books, and two titles I remember are A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Betty,
And The Bell Jar. Mm-hmm. But the only required book I had to read was Gogol's Dead Souls. So I'm curious, what kinds of high school reading lists, what were the books?
What were students in the 60s assigned to read? You were a young woman reading The Bell Jar. What did you think of it? Do you remember that?
It was a little disturbing, but interesting.
Okay. All I remember that was she went on about chicken necks after her first date. But okay. Thank you, Beth, very much for that. I appreciate that call. Yeah. What do we all think? What, Kevin, Passy, Andrew, what do you think? What did you, you're not old enough. I am. I mean, I remember the 60s pretty much. And I remember Huck Finn. I mean, I wasn't.
I was going to say, Huck Finn's really popular in the 50s for the kind of novel we should be reading. So I would assume it would have carried over,
One of the assigned books that I had for summer reading, which I always had throughout the 60s or my school years, was A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember because it was hard. I also had to read The Prince and the Pauper.
And I remember as well A Separate Piece. That was a John Knowles. Mm-hmm. That was a big big part of the books then.
Yeah, I was born in the early 60s, so my assigned reading was in the 70s, but I remember Flowers for Algernon being, that was a really popular book, and that was a wonderful book.
Yeah. And we were assigned what they called then black literature. Richard Wright, we were assigned a lot of Richard Wright and Langston Hughes back then. It was considered a progressive school district. This was 1969, so, you know. 292-8513 is the number to call. 614 is our area code. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. I'm Christopher Purdy talking with Andrew Strombach, with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith. We're going to take a break right now just for a moment. We'll be back for the last segment of the show. Don't go away. And I'm back. I'm Christopher Purdy. We are back with Cassie Rose, Kevin Griffith, and Andrew Strombach, All Sides Weekend Books. We've been talking about the books that were being read by the characters on the TV series Mad Men, which is certainly a huge success set in the, well, it began in the early 60s, and it then went on basically for that decade. And we were talking about some of the poets you mentioned, Kevin? Mm-hmm.
We were talking about poets who rose to prominence in the 60s. You mentioned Anne Sexton, and I was thinking the teacher of both Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath, Robert Lowell, Lowell's poetry, especially in Life Studies, which was the first book to be labeled confessional poetry. You know, he has a poem in there called Man and Wife, which talks about his marriage falling apart and lying on the bed, tamed by Milltown. Milltown was the all-purpose tranquilizer at that time, the sort of the tranquilized early 60s. That would be a perfect book for one of the characters to read. Lowell sort of ushered in that whole suburban sort of aphasia, you know, that suburban loss of place and suburban neuroses, all that came to a head with Robert Lowell.
Andrew, tell us, I really need to ask you specifics about, you've mentioned Valley of the Dolls and a few others. What specific books are you really teaching that they were reading in the show?
So for this semester, it was The Last Picture Show, it was Valley of the Dolls, Rosemary's Baby, I think I've mentioned all these. We read, this is the book that's not featured in the show, we read The Last Days of Louisiana Red by Ishmael Reed, which kind of looks back on the protest cultures of the 60s. And then we read a spy novel by Leon Uris, which is kind of a crappy novel, frankly, but it was read by someone on the show. And I thought, you know, we mentioned Fleming, and it's probably not terribly worse than Fleming. And then also the Fixer, the Malamud there.
Okay, then. We have a call from Michael in Columbus, and he has two authors that, I wish we had thought of that. Michael, go ahead.
Yes. Hi. I was a teenager during the 60s, and Steinbeck and Salinger were both very important during that time still, and I think Salinger might have been an author that some of these characters probably would have been reading.
They might have been actually trying to work with him because although he was so elusive, he was really seminal even then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Michael, thank you. That's a great point with Snyder. And what about John Updike, Andrew? What about the Rabbit series? Was that later?
No, those books came out in the 60s, from what I recall. I'm not a huge Updike fan. I haven't read much Updike at all, but. Those would have been entirely appropriate for anyone to read on the show. I think that's a good name to have in circulation here.
Now, Andrew, here's the $64 million question on the show like this. And so what books are on your bedside table right now?
Okay, so I was thinking about this because I knew you were going to ask me about this. So I just finished, not that long ago, Rachel Kushner's The Flamethrowers, which came out last year. It was on the New York Times.
I loved that book.
Good, so great. I love the world that she brings us into, the 70s world. And then the other book I'm reading now is a work, I guess it's of history. It's actually by a friend of mine. It's called American Fun, and it sort of traces, I don't know, all these oddball moments in American history, like Thomas Merton, who was like this, outlier in the Puritan settlement, but who was much more concerned with sort of, I don't know, erecting giant maples and dancing around them than he was with sort of like following God's law. And then he has this whole great thing about the Sons of Liberty with Samuel Adams and how they drew energy from the dock outside bars of the time. And he brings it right up to the yippies in the 60s about Abbie Hoffman saying like he wanted to start a political party that also would be like a party he wanted to go to. So, yeah, that's what I've been reading. Both those books are really great.
How about you, Kevin?
Well, speaking, that's great that you mentioned oddball history. And I have something that I was reading. I love weird stuff. So what is the weirdest books I can find? I have found sort of the weirdest coffee table book I've ever seen. And it combines oddball history with the advertising industry. It's called Everything's Coming Up Profits, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals. And apparently in the 60s and 70s, corporations like BP, plumbing corporations, GAF, Linoleum, would have these big get-togethers of their employees and actually hire Broadway producers to produce musicals completely based upon like their annual reports. And it goes, this book, Everything Coming Up Profits, goes through probably about 100 albums that were made. They'd make limited edition albums for all their employees. The quote-unquote Sergeant Pepper of industrial musicals was one released in 1969 called The Bathrooms Are Coming. It's an original musical presented by American Standard, and it contains songs like My Bathroom. Here's some of the lyrics from the song My Bathroom, sung by a woman, a female character. My bathroom is much more than it may seem. It's where I wash and where I cream, a special place where I can stay and cream and dream and dream and cream. This is wonderful stuff. So if you're looking for oddball history and sort of a Mad Men angle, Everything's Coming Up Profits by Steve Young and Sport Murphy, it's for you.
Somebody's going to write a Broadway musical about those.
Already in the works.
It's probably being done, yes. Right. Mm-hmm. Cassie Rose, what's on your bedside table? What are you reading these days?
Well, I just put a post on The Longest Chapter about three novels that are coming in May. So I'd like to talk about one of them, which is called All the Light We Cannot See. It's by Anthony Doerr, who is an Ohio author and a favorite among readers and critics for his beautiful prose and his unforgettable stories. And so I would recommend that everyone look at this, and this is certainly going to be on my table. It's a World War II story, and there are parallel lives of a young blind girl in Paris, France, and a German boy, and their parallel lives until they meet in 1944 in a small town in France. Anthony Doerr was in that town. He got inspiration with it. And there's a wonderful video when he talks about the book and how it came to be and the themes that he wanted to explore, which were about one of them is the radio and how he got inspiration. And the young German boy is very technically capable, as well as he wanted to explore how nationalism overcomes a young mind. And it sounds like it's a wonderful book that it will be involving and pretty good for the bedside table as well as any beach read. So if you're starting to plan your vacation books, it's called All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr.
Yeah, let's do a little pre-seasonal beach read subsect here. I mean, anybody have a favorite beach book we're looking forward to reading again?
I could probably jump in and recommend also a reading again. I'll say Winter's Tale by Mark Helprin, which came out in 1983. And the only reason it comes to mind is because I just read it for the first time this month. And I read it because the movie came out in February and got horrible reviews. And I thought, well, I will read the book instead. And it is The Miracle of Peter Lake. And anyone who has read this book will know what I mean by that. But it would be a great beach read because it's very involving.
And you have a house full of kids, Kevin. You must go to the beach, right?
Oh, yeah, we do. And I have an excellent book. I had never heard of this man, but thanks to Media Overdrive at the public library and my Kindle, a lot of authors whose books went out of print in the 80s are now making a comeback via Kindle. And Robert McCammon, Boy's Life, just an outstanding novel. Robert McCammon is kind of a poor man Stephen King. He came out about the same time, but never got the traction Stephen King did. But Boy's Life is just an outstanding novel. It's hefty. It's a good beach read, and that's about 500 pages long. And it is what it says it is. It's about the life of a boy, Corey, who's growing up in Zephyr, Alabama. It's got it all the things you love about summer in it. Bikes, the last day of school, monsters. There's a creature that lives in the river that he has to confront, the evil townspeople, bullies. baseball, it's all there. Wonderfully done, uplifting, sort of frightening at the same time. But generally, if you had a child who's 7th to, 10 to 14 years old, it'd be a great novel for them to read. It's
don't
wonderful.
Don't let them read Valley of the Dolls even today.
No.
Right? No, okay. No. Bill from Grove City. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I thought of another one because you were talking about World War II. I think just about everybody read Catch-22.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
But the books I was going to say would be maybe there was one called The Naked Ape by a guy named Desmond Morris that was controversial, and a lot of people read it, including me. And there was Hell's Angels by Hunter Thompson.
That's a great book. That's my favorite Hunter Thompson book. The other ones are too excessive. That one, I think, is really focused and really great. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. It's a great book.
Yep.
Thank you, Bill, for your call. Tell me about Hunter Thompson.
Well, Hunter Thompson, I guess, is, he's one of the new journalists, right? These people that are trying to sort of take the techniques of novels and apply them to journalism. So I think of him like Tom Wolfe, or I think of him like Mailer as well, or Joan Didion would be the other person to think of. I mean, Thompson's the kind of experiences that he personally engages in are a little bit different than the ones that Didion and Wolf experience, but same general technique. Yeah, yeah. I'm a little doubtful about Thompson for the most part. I guess it's the excesses around him that I doubt. But I like that Hunter or the Hell's Angels book a lot.
Now, one book I remember, I think I was in sixth grade when it came out, and everybody was reading it, including all the girls in the sixth grade class were reading Love Story by Eric Siegel. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was iconic, even at the very beginning.
Yeah, so it became a best movie, and
yeah, I mean,
people went over and over again.
Completely identified with that, and I can see people. You know, I think of an advertising agency like in Mad Men wanting to go after the hot author at the time, the really hot author, because they would figure some kind of lucre-filled project to go with them. And I think Eric Siegel, who I think was in medical school briefly at the time, might have been someone.
The mention of Joan Didion brings to mind Slouching Toward Bethlehem, which came out in, 1968, I think. Beautiful collection of essays, the kind that I have read it a couple times. And I think also it was sort of set the bar for what essays should be and in going forward. Very personal, very evocative, very, I don't know, it had a style about it that just was different from all others, combining the journalism and her own feelings and insight. Truly a great collection of essays.
Yeah, she's so good. I forgot to mention that we have been reading that book. It's not a book that's featured on the show, but it's one of the two books I use to give the students a kind of sense of context, right? Because she's really good at, showing us Haight-Ashbury or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And a great essay in there about leaving New York.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Some Dreamers of the Golden Dream about this murder in California is really, really great, too. Yeah.
I'm wondering also of the poets we discussed earlier, of Sexton and Lowell, if young people were discouraged from reading them when they were new because they were confessional and they were kind of downers. I mean, I wonder if that's something that's germane to the conversation. Maybe, Kevin, you could weigh in on that one a little bit.
You know, I don't know. That's interesting how poetry was initially received then.
Yeah.
I know with Plath, of course, initially no one read her poetry, and the sad thing about Plath is that when she died, she was referred to as the novelist Sylvia Plath, who wrote The Bell Jar, which is really sad. It wasn't until over the, well into the 70s, Crossing the Water, when that was released, that her poetry began to get a lot more critical attention. So, and Lowell's Life Studies, too, that was quite controversial. A lot of people dismissed that as non-poetry because it didn't follow a prescribed format for how poems should be, or at least how the authorities in poetry felt poetry should be. That's really interesting. And it's interesting to compare, if you think about it, compare the poets who rose to prominence in the 60s versus the poets who are popular today. And we still do have popular poets, but it's Mary Oliver and Billy Collins, completely different types of people, non-confessional, but certainly not in a threatening way or a disturbing way or something that's going to upset the apple cart or anything like that.
Sexton lived in the town next to where I grew up. And she used to do readings in the area to local public libraries. So I mean, I saw her a lot because she was like the mom in the next town who was writing this. And when people didn't really encourage people my age to go listen to her read, although I did. I mean, because she was known to be kind of a, you know, a, not obscene, but troubling. She was, you weren't supposed to be troubling back then, really. And she really was out there with that. I'm just putting that out for what it's worth. We have a call from Mike, who wants to talk about The Street Without Joy. Hi, Mike.
Oh, wow.
Mike?
Yeah, hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, just the two books that remain in my mind from the early 60s is I Was in College in ROTC. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
And we got one of our ROTC advisors was smart enough to make us all read Street Without Joy and Vietnam Diary by Richard Tregaskis. And, of course, a year later, I was there.
Oh.
So that's...
Now, that's a book I don't know.
Well, it's a book written by Bernard Paul in the 1950s about the French fighting the Vietnamese, but it became a bestseller in the 60s because of all the military that read it. And it's still read today, by the way. It's taught.
Mm.
That is a landmark book, and I actually just came upon it through my book collecting and have a copy of that and learned that it was very much passed among all of the military, and especially those in Vietnam, because it did talk about, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it talked about the French involved in Vietnam and was so forecasting in a way what we were going to be up against.
Yeah, I always think of The Quiet American, Graham Greene, in that context as well, because isn't that, I believe that's set in French-occupied Vietnam.
I know it's set in Vietnam, but yes, it is. It is set in French-occupied Vietnam.
And it has an American advisor, and so you can sort of see the writing on the wall in some ways, the way the novel treats that American advisor.
In the few minutes we have left, I'm just curious to know, does anyone think that reading any one of these books that were featured on the show might have changed the reader, the reader's character or outlook? Were reading these books specifically that important, or couldn't you imagine a character being changed by what they've been reading?
A character on Mad Men?
Yes.
Well, certainly if someone was reading, if one of the women was reading The Feminine Mystique, I would think that would change them.
Well, they were also, but there are a couple of characters on that program, as I recall, who were, I guess, would have been called feminists at the time in a pejorative way because
true.
They wanted respect and equal treatment. What about that, Andrew? Do you think people would have been changed, characters would have been changed?
By reading something like The Feminine Mystique?
Or whatever was featured in the actual show, because I know that's the crux of your course.
Yeah, so I think the one time you see that happening is with Draper and the Book of O'Hara poems.
Oh.
There's the one episode, I think it's season two, where you see Draper kind of going off, and he's kind of introduced to these poems by this, I guess we'd call him a hipster now, and he sort of... rejects Draper, but then Draper takes these poems in, he starts reading them and thinking about them, and he really identifies with the kind of speakers in O'Hara's poems, and it seems to be kind of a shifting point for his character. His character never really evolves, but at least at that moment, he seems to take in O'Hara's points and sort of dwell on them. So that's the only moment I can think of where somebody's reading something and then it sort of translates into a character change.
Well, groovy, everybody. I thank you for this discussion of Mad Men and the literature about the program. We've had a very stimulating, I mean, I've been writing things down for the last hour. I thank you, Andrew Strombeck at Wright State University. Your course is called?
Mad Men in Literature, 1965 to 1970, the second version of it.
I thank you for being with us today. Cassie Rose, your blog is thelongestchapter.com, which is always a source for what's good and what's not, because you let us know both. And you are featuring right now what book on your blog?
Actually, three novels, and it's just three novels coming in May.
Okay. And Kevin Griffith, Capital University, teacher of creative writing. Is there a novel that would be a good Bible for teaching of creative writing that people should read? Like, there's one novel, Anna Karenina, according to...
I would say Sophie's Choice.
Sophie's Choice.
Set your bar high. Yeah.
I thank you all, and I thank you all for listening. I'm Christopher Purdy. This has been All Sides Weekend here on 89.7 NPR. Our producer is Michael DeBonis. Thank you, associate producer Amy Jurevich. Thank you to Olivia, Justin, Emmy, Julia, and Leticia. And I thank all of you for listening. Good afternoon. Go to the library.